newsletter that we sent out, and I'm really curious of what some of your answers might be. So the question was this: why do we do good things? So just think about that for a moment. And after you think you might have some answers, what would be some things that you would say? Why do you do good things? Yes, Irene? Because it makes you feel good. Okay, good, good. Why else? Yes, Michael. To help others. Okay, all right. So it's an altruistic, like, I'm doing this for the benefit of someone else. Rich?
Moral obligation.
Moral obligation. That something within us, there's a moral code that we all have, and there, we want to try to follow that moral code. Yeah, okay, good, yeah. Okay.
And the right person happened to be there at the right time. They needed that help.
Okay, and so, but then why did you do it? Because, I mean, you do have a choice to.
Honestly, I'm blind faith.
Blind, so it was just faith that for some reason I'm here, and so I'm trusting, and I'm guessing the faith is in regards to God. So, yeah, okay. Josh? Do, yeah, so that's an interesting thing. Doing bad things makes you feel guilty, which, of course, ties into Ritzing, which is, why do you have the guilt? Because somewhere in this is this moral code that we have. Catherine? Okay, so you're going to go with JR and say it's something about God. There's something godly about this whole thing. All right, good. Yeah. Yes, thank you. Yeah, because that's... I forgot what someone else said, but they said, well, because when you do something to make you feel good, is that selfish?
No.
It's not selfish. No, well, but so are you doing it for the benefit of others, or are you doing it because it makes you feel good? And then sometimes maybe you do something nice for someone else because maybe you'll get something in return.
Because it's needed.
Okay, so you're going to go back with moral code. Okay, yes. Jacob.
Because
Jesus did the best thing, so you're tying it back in with the God component of it. Yeah, it's very interesting when you think of why we do what we do, especially when it comes to being in a faith relationship with God. Because is it true that people who are not believers in God, people that don't have any religious following, do they often do good things? Yeah, I mean, it's... They do it. There's times I've met people who are incredible atheists. They are complete non-believers, but they still do nice things, but they don't do it for a godly reason. They do it for something else, possibly the moral issue. And then there's other times when people who are in a faith relationship with God, do we always choose to do the good thing? And this is where... The concept, and we're gonna the writer of Ecclesiastes, as he's getting closer and closer to the end, he's bringing God more and more into the discussion, but he's gonna hit a topic that I know not every Christian denomination buys into, but it is something that I buy into and that the Lutheran Church buys into, and that is what's called the total depravity of man. And it's interesting to see how that works. Irene? Explain my moral issue? Well, that means like it goes back to that somewhere in us, we have a moral code. That even those who don't believe in God, when they do bad things, there is a sense of guilt that comes across them. Now, a lot of people will do everything in their power to suppress that guilt, right? So that they can do bad things without feeling. But they all have it. And that's the same way when people who are non-Christians will do good things. Why? Because it just simply makes them feel good. They don't know why it makes them feel good. They might not know that it was God that imprinted that code in them. But again, it's important for us to really accept the concept that all of us, though we are becoming greater and greater in our righteousness, right? That's our goal as Christians, that as we live our life, our righteousness, we are molded more and more into the likeness of Jesus. But while you are still drawing breath here on this earth, you are still horribly wicked. And I can prove it because of what happened to me. Because you know me, I'm very moral, I'm very righteous, I do all good things, right? Yeah, don't laugh too loud, Rich. He knows me. So we're Jacob and I were on the plane, we're flying to St. Louis, and it's weird because, what was it, we left at 6, and as we're going, it's getting later. So we're flying, it's a four-hour flight from LAX to St. Louis, and we're going, and it's great, and you know, it's kind of boring. And then we're, I don't know, maybe 45 minutes from landing at St. Louis. And I'm like, hey, wow, you know, what a great plane ride. Nothing exciting happened. When all of a sudden, we're in the 26th row. So we're like, we're near the back of the plane. And in row 24 on the other side, so we're D, E, and F, and they're A, B, and C, right? So two rows up and on that side, not very far from us. All of a sudden, this guy stands up, and he's very animated. He's like this to the steward that's in the back. And, you know, the steward, I see him walking forward, and he'd been up and down the aisles. The dude was like 18 years old. I'm pretty sure this was his first job. And, of course, you know, he's at Spirit Airlines, so it's like, we'll take anyone that has a pulse. This is great. I have no idea how much training this dude had, but he's there, and he's got this look in his eyes. And Jacob and I were like, what? What's going on over here? And so then all of a sudden, the steward runs to the back, and then the guy starts saying, help me, help me. And I'm like, what in the world is going on? And then he stops, and the guy, the steward, is running back and forth. He doesn't know what to do. And finally, the guy yells out, she stopped breathing. And I'm like, oh, it's like bad. It's not like little bad. It's bad. And all of a sudden, someone yells out, does anyone know CPR? And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is getting really bad. Like, I kind of know it. I had to get training at the preschool, but there's got to be someone that's better at this than me. And then they get on the little walkie-talkie thing, and they're like, is anyone here a medical professional, a doctor, a nurse, or something like that? And from the front of the plane, because that's where all the rich people are at, so the run of the, they, two people stand up, and this one woman, she is booking down the, she gets right down, and she says, I am a pulmonary pediatric surgeon. You qualify. Yes, you know something about medicine. And the other guy didn't say anything, and I thought he kind of acted like nurse-ish. Like he was very like, I'm here to help and assist and do stuff. But thankfully, while that's happening, the guy is shaking, and we found out later it was his wife, and she wakes up. So I don't think she stopped breathing. I think she passed out, which still is bad, right? So the whole time I'm sitting there going, oh my goodness, this is really bad. I'm like, I just started like privately praying. But then the sinner took over. And you know what flashed through my brain? I hope she's okay because I really don't want to be diverted to Kansas City. Isn't that horrible? This is, now, if you were on the flight, would you have thought that? You'd be like, no, I would just be, you know, home. And I'm sitting there like, how horrible of a person I am. And thankfully, I didn't like say it out loud or like, you know, I was able to suppress that, like, that's bad. I was able to realize what I thought was bad. And thankfully, and then this was where it was also cool because I was wondering, you know how people on planes, I think that's where like the total depravity of man like shows up the most, right? So, yeah, and at the DMV, that is true. So we land, and of course they get on the loudspeaker, and they're like, ladies and gentlemen, when we get to the gate, can all of you please stay seated to allow this woman, who's in row 24, she's in the back, to allow her to get forward. And you know what I thought? There is going to be a couple knuckleheads. Why? Because I'm a knucklehead myself. And I said, I bet you someone up there, they're going to start sitting, they're going to clog the aisle. And it was crazy. So we land, you hear the bing, and you know, the bing is like Pavlov's dogs to stand up and rush forward as fast as possible. And it happened, and no one moved an inch. And these people got up, and they walked all the way to the front, and they got out. Jacob and I were like, we want to clap for the, like, hey, plane, you guys did it right. Way to go. We have these two instances where we see people doing good, but then also there's this sense of evil that is part of us. Making sure that we acknowledge our sinfulness is really super important because we all have it. It's those people who are righteous, who then do not understand their own sinful depravity, I really believe those are the ones that Satan loves to target, because then you're not thinking about it. I remember as a kid, filled with lots of evil thoughts, and I'm like, I can't wait till I'm older and I will have like grown and not be thinking evil thoughts anymore. But I still think evil thoughts. What is wrong with, like, why is that? That's just terrible. And I thought that I was going to eventually, I know theology-wise, you can't fully eradicate the sinful man. I know that theologically, but I'm like, I can get pretty close, can't I? And I'm realizing how difficult it is to live that life. So chapter 9, are you there? Let's go through this, and we're going to ask questions of why we do good, the total depravity, and see where this leads us. Ecclesiastes chapter 9. And he's starting to give the hint. I've already given you the answer in chapter 12, which is everything in this world is meaningless without God. Your life is meaningless without God. Your finances are meaningless without God. Your purpose is meaningless without God. And why is that? Because you are all going to die. It's just the way it goes. You're going to die, whether you're rich or poor, male, female, black, white, status high, status low, powerful, not, y'all die. So God needs to be a part of our life for our life to then have any meaning. So I reflected on this and concluded that the righteous and the wise, and what they do are in God's hands. So he's marching towards this concept that God is the most important, and especially for us who are righteous and wise. Please be careful that anytime we get righteous, anytime we get wise, we could be tempted to think that we are doing this all on our own to the point that we don't need God. Again, after I had my sinful thought, I prayed like, God, I'm sorry. And that's where that those flashes of sin keep us grounded in what God is doing and how much we need God. Because although we are all in God's hands, no one knows whether love or hate awaits them. Ecclesiastes is the balance between the Proverbs and Job. The book of Proverbs says, do good, and good things happen to you, right? Book of Job says you could do really good things and a lot of bad stuff still happens to you. And here we get that balance, knowing that people who are righteous and following God, sometimes some bad things are going to happen to you. And there are sometimes that evil people who have no godly code in them whatsoever and they just simply pursue everything evil, sometimes good things happen to them. That's just the way it is. But he reminds us all share a common destiny. The righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who does not. As it is with the good man, so with the sinner. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes them all. You're all going to die. It's the way it is. So we have to ask the question of why then do we do good things? What is our motivation? If our motivation is of a sinful ilk, what Heather said, you know, sometimes we do good things because we want to feel good. Sometimes we want to do it so that we can get something back from someone else. You know, why do we offer to pick that person up from the airport? Maybe they'll give us $25. Why do we help our friend when they're studying for a test? Well, maybe because they'll help you then when it comes time to do the term paper. Why do you help that coworker in the office? Is it to make sure that the boss realizes how valuable you are and that maybe you'll get a raise? Why do we do what we do? Asking that and understanding our depravity is important, because this is where it says, in the middle of verse 3, the hearts of men, and hopefully you know this when it says men, this would be like mankind. So Yeah, sorry, women, you're also in part of this as well. Though you seem to have it a lot better than us guys. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live, and afterward they join the dead. So how long will you be wicked? Until the day you die. Isn't that great? Why? 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 Why do we have this? And we can go into the theology of it. It's quite fascinating. You have this concept that shows up, especially Paul lays this out, this concept of original sin. And it goes back to Adam and Eve, right? Eve decides to eat a piece of fruit, and so we all know that it's the woman's fault. No, because who was standing right there with Eve? Like a big lump on like, Eve, you're going to eat it. Okay. Oh, you want me? Yeah, I'll take a bite too. Yeah, like guys just stand back and watch evil happen around us, and then we often then participate in it. We all have this, and it's interesting when we talk about Adam and Eve. It was fascinating. Jacob and I were talking about this a little bit. It's as if, I loved how one professor said this, it's as if the entire human race said, we nominate Adam and Eve as the best shot to do things right. And we nominated, they went up there, and they failed miserably. Because if you say you would do it better, you are a liar. They were our best shot. So we all have this in us. And it's terrible. And understanding that as Heather said in the children's message, even though we're evil, God says, I love you and I want a relationship with you. So for anyone who is sitting and thinking, there's no way God could love me because of what I do, it's just absolutely wrong. Some of you might be saying, well, gosh, at least I'm not doing things. I'm just maybe thinking bad thoughts, and I'm just not acting on them. No, Jesus solved that issue as well, saying the mere contemplation of sin causes you to be defiled. Every day, every hour, every minute, we need God. Doing a good thing for other people outside of God is meaningless. It does nothing. Doing things for God, even though they seem insignificant, if they're done for the purpose of glorifying God, are powerful. Jesus stated it this way. If you give a cup of cold water to a kid who is thirsty and you do it because you want to honor me, that's good. It's as if you've done it unto me. If you give a cup of cold water to them so that they will finally shut up and go to sleep, that might come from a sinful nature, and you better, you know, apologize and then say, Lord, please help me to, you know, serve and love people. This is the struggle that we have our entire lives. And then he goes to this interesting discussion, verse 4, anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. These are discussions that kind of put to bed any concept of purgatory. Like, once you die, that's it. That's the end. You don't have extra shots afterwards like, oh my gosh, I messed up. I often thought, what would happen? This would be, I think, a great evangelistic strategy from God, is that he will, after you die, allow you to come into his presence before making a final determination. Because wouldn't that then like ensure that everyone's going to become a believer, right? You are a non-believer. You don't believe in God. You don't believe he exists. And then you die, and then you're in front of him. You'd be like, I believe. And he'd be like, okay, good. You did that within 30 seconds. That's the cutoff time. You're in. It'd be a great evangelistic strategy. That's not how God set it up. You live. He gives plenty of opportunity for us to know who he is. So anyone who is among the living has hope. If you are drawing breath, you have hope. If you are a nasty, horrible sinner, and yet you still have a pulse, you have hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. Verse 5, for the living know that they will die, But the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even the memory of them is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. And he does the same argument that just drives me nuts. We all know we're sinful. We need God. When we die, that's the end of the story. And so then how should you live? And I want to talk a little bit about how good it is that make sure that what you are doing is in honoring of God, and make sure that you're giving at least 3 God bless yous to the Starbucks barista when she actually gets your order. And when that car runs through the red light and almost destroys your car, that stupid F-250, it's just a story that was told to me. It wasn't me. And you just want to curse them out. You're making sure that you pray for them and that you love them. And then if you get out, just don't deck them. Every aspect of your being needs to make sure that you're saying God at least 12 times in an hour. No, this is, again, what the writer of Ecclesiastes says. And it drives me nuts a little bit. But then the older I get, the happier I get about this. So it says, go eat your food with gladness and drink. Oh, there you go. Yeah. All the guys are like, hey, honey, you listening to this? And drink your wine with a joyful heart. Amen. Preach it. We're preaching God's word here. For it is now that God favors what you do. Do you realize that? Some people have a hard time. I remember when I was younger and I would get these commands from God. The one that just drove me the baddest: pray continually. Who here likes that commandment? I know I don't. Pray continually? So I start worrying, like, I'm preaching a lot. Maybe I need to pray sooner. Don't say amen to that. I'm out in the grocery store. I should be praying. How do I pray continually? And then I realize what this is saying. You're going to eat your food with gladness. You're going to drink your wine with a joyful heart. For it is now that God favors what you do. As a believer in God, your life is now prayer and worship. I was reminded of this recently because I'm always trying to figure out, make sure that what we say and what we do is reflective of our theology. It was pointed out to me that there are many times that after the service is over and we're getting ready to sing the final song, sometimes I say the words, and let's, come to worship. As if what we're doing now is not worship. As if singing equals worship. And that's wrong. Do you know that driving a car can be worship to God? Do you know that going out to a fancy restaurant can be worship to God? Do you know that eating Rice Krispie treats, brownies, something, can be worship to God? I just find that incredible. It is such a freeing thing because God looks at me and says, you are horrible and sinful, and you're going to want to live your life trying to make up for all the evil you do. And he says, I've already done it. I've already saved you. You are forgiven, and now everything you do is in worship to me. So eat your double doubles with gladness and drink your beer with a joyful heart. For it is now that God favors what you do. Always be clothed in white. What does it mean to be clothed in white? Clothed in white means that we are forgiven, that we are loved. It reminds us of our baptism, how God has given us new clothes. Live every day as if you're saved. Now again, what does that mean? Does that mean make sure you say God bless you to at least 12 people during the day? Does that mean, yeah, I better not speed because that wouldn't be honoring of God? No, it's living a life in gratefulness and thankfulness. Every aspect of it is good to God. Live like you are fully forgiven, and always anoint your head with oil. That's the idea that God comes and he consecrates, and he says, I am blessing your entire life, and that the Spirit goes with you. And so that even when you think evil thoughts like, I hope we don't get diverted to Kansas City, God says, I've forgiven that. You're an evil human being, Mark Manning, but I love you and I've already forgiven you. So now live like that. And now I do it not because I'm trying to earn favor with God, but because God has already made me righteous. That's why I do the things that I do. And enjoy life. Yes, there's a balance, right? Some of you are like really uptight. You have a lot of anxiety and you worry about things. And you're like, I can't be too happy because happy Christians are not, those aren't, you know, that's not good. God doesn't want you to be too happy. You know, God wants you to be a little bit miserable, a little bit, you know, painful. Like you have kind of a half smile on your face. Like, yeah, I worship God. Because, you know, he just kills all the joy in the rest of your life. So some of you need to let go and relax a little bit. Some of you maybe are a little bit too relaxed and you do a little bit too much enjoyment of beer and wine and other things in life, and maybe you need to rethink those things. Again, what a wonderful thing that God says, live your life with joy. Verse 9, enjoy life with your wife, whom you love. All the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days. I think this is the preacher in him. He's like, enjoy marriage, enjoy relationships, because guess what? It's all going to fall apart anyway, and your relationship is meaningless, and your life is meaningless, and you're going to die. So enjoy your spouse. That was wonderful. Well, I enjoy my spouse. I love my wife. I love my wife all the days of this meaningless life I have. For this is your lot in life and your toilsome labor under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the grave where you are going, there is neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. So if you're going to live this life, live it to the fullest. Isn't that what Jesus said? I came so that you might have life and have it to the fullest. So if you are a Rams fan, celebrate the Rams fully and completely. If you enjoy going out to eat, go and enjoy that scrumptious steak and say, thank you, God, because things are going to be different. Love your spouse. Love your children with all the gusto you have. Love your parents the same way. He goes on. Now, this one's going to be a little bit interesting because I think that the way God does these things, this one's going to hit a little bit close to home. I've seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise or wealth to the brilliant or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. Again, the book of Proverbs says something quite different. Live your life in honor of God. Follow his commands. And those who do good will be receiving blessings from God. But I think we've all experienced it, have we not? That sometimes we do what is right, and the bad stuff still happens. And those are the painful times in life when we feel stuck and we feel like, God, I'm trying to do everything I can to love you and to honor you with my life. Why does my life keep falling apart? And I'm not talking about your life is falling apart because of the dumb choices you make. I'm saying your life may fall apart because of other choices that other people make and how that affects you. And you may be really, really hurting, and you look around and you see other people, and they're not trying to honor God with their life, and they seem to be getting ahead. They seem to be succeeding. And this is what he's trying to say. There are times that lazy people get wealthy. There are times when wicked people get rewards. There are times when you do everything you can to honor God and you see nothing from it. So again, why do you do the good things? This is going to expose an even more sinister sin in all of us. That many a times we do good because we want to be blessed by God. Maybe it manifests itself in fear, like a fear of I don't want to be punished by God But also I want to do good things because I know God will bless me. Well, guess what? Sometimes you're going to do good for God and you're not going to get blessed. And it's going to be hard and it's going to be painful because that's what takes place all too often. And that's why he then says, verse 12, moreover, no man knows when his hour will come. No one here knows when we will die. It could happen at any time. As fish are caught in a cruel net or birds are taken in a snare, so men are trapped by evil times that fall expectedly on them. And then he finishes up with this very poignant concept that I don't really think I need to explain too much because I think all of us watch the news. I also saw I saw under the sun this example of wisdom that greatly impressed me. There was once a small city with only a few people in it, and a powerful king came against it, surrounded it, and built huge siege works against it. Because sometimes it happens, doesn't it? You see people struggling with the world stage right now, and you've got a country that is weak, right? It doesn't have all the money, and there is an entity coming against it that is huge and powerful and has a lot of resources. Who will win that battle? Does the victory always go to the strongest? No. Check out what he says. Verse 15, now there lived in that city a man poor but wise, and he saved the city by his wisdom. But nobody remembered that poor man. Just so you know, there was a time when we didn't have social media and everything was, you know, broadcast 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But there are times when it's not strength that saves. It's not power. It's not horses. It's not tanks. We trust in God. And we might end up being face down. You might find yourself in a very similar situation when it looks as if the entire world is against you and it seems like evil has surrounded you and they built siege works up against you and everything that is going on in your life seems to be falling apart and you're being shelled and you're being attacked and you have no idea how in the world am I going to get out of this. God is always with you. And you may not have all the answers, you may not have all the wisdom, but you might have faith that trusts in the God who does. When you trust for God and his wisdom, and why do you do it? Do you do it so that you can just feel good about yourself? Do you have that wisdom and you help other people so that you'll be remembered? Because sometimes you might do something for someone else and they will never, ever remember you for that. I think of all of the people in my life who've been very influential, people who have spoke into my life in powerful ways and has guided me along a path, and I probably couldn't even name a tenth of them. And I'm so thankful that these are people who did what they did, not because they got a reward, but simply because they were honoring God. And I just find that amazing. So when you are faced with adversity and you're wondering, will anyone even remember? Or maybe you go through a difficult time and you have the strength of God. No one may never even remember that later on, but that does not matter. Because the only thing that matters is your faith in God and trusting that he will always be with you. So I said, wisdom is better than strength. But the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are no longer heeded. And I don't know, I just love this. Do I even need to explain verse 17? The quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of a ruler of fools. Wow. It's not about how loud you scream. It's not about how animated you become. Sometimes having that quiet wisdom and trusting in God is going to carry you further, because verse 18, wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. One sinner destroys much good, and one righteous man saves us all. we trust that God, when we have a mountain that is insurmountable, a requirement to enter heaven that demands perfection, and we look at our poor, miserable, meaningless lives and we wonder, there is no help. There is no way for this to be done. Even Jesus, when he says, be perfect as I am perfect, and the disciples are like, that's impossible. And he said, exactly. For man, this is impossible. But God, all things are possible because he's going to save you. He's not going to save you with armies or tanks. He's not going to save you with the might of angels that come down and rescue you. He's going to save you by the death of his Son, Jesus Christ, who did not scream or cry out, who did not get animated, but simply just said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, and it is finished. And that is what we trust in.